It really is fine being up here, I'll tell you. My name's Steve Mitchell. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here, and it's good to be sober. John stopped by a couple minutes ago and asked me to not make him look like an idiot with my talk. I always appreciate that kind of a rousing welcome. It is really good to be here. I was invited last year, I think, because a guy got sick, and I said I could come, and then what happened is I went upstairs and looked and found out I said I'd do something else, so I came back down and told John, called him back and told him, so he invited me for this year, and I was really thrilled to be invited. It's always nice to be asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never gotten used to it. This is not the first time I've tried to do something like this, but I tell you, it's never easy. And it always seems like such a good idea when somebody asks you to do something. But there's always that time just before when you really wish they hadn't bothered. You know that's not true, but that's kind of a talking point to how I feel right now. And I don't know why. It doesn't make much difference. I mean, sometimes I get settled down, and once I get going, sometimes I never get settled down and have to give the whole talk just a wreck. But it doesn't make much difference. My job is to show up and give whatever it is that I have to give. I've learned here what we all have to learn is it's impossible to give anything in Alcoholics Anonymous or in life away. Whatever you send out has to come back, and certainly that's true with the power of this program and practice of these principles. I'm really excited about, I loved that long airplane ride yesterday. I'm not one of those people that bemoans the air travel. I love it. I just completely go away in the sky and forget about everything and traveling with my wife and my sponsor, which was is always nice. I was reading a book on the life story of Jane Goodall, the lady who spent her lifetime looking into chimpanzees and baboons and wild dogs, and people have always thought that's bizarre, but I'll guarantee it makes a lot more sense than looking for answers in a bottle. She said that the thrust of her entire life's work was to try to make a correlation between chimpanzees and human behavior. And I suspect we were trying to do something similar to that with a bottle, trying to make some kind of correlation, and just never could get it lined up. Or if you did, you wouldn't be in here unless you're some kind of a visitor. So the other thing that's nice about this, I have a very real sense, you know, if you're in this room this morning, I always hope that somebody will be helped, and we ask for newcomers, and I hope that someone will be helped by what I do here today, but I take great comfort in knowing that if you're in this room on your own bones, there ain't anything I'm going to do to make you worse. I mean, you're bad enough already, and I'm not going to hurt you. If you got in here and you're supposed to be here, there's nothing I'm going to do to throw you off. I know that. So, yesterday when we got to Las Vegas, I can't find anything. I told my wife on the way to the meeting this morning that I don't think I could get back here, even though I was in the meeting last night without seeking directions. And so, you know, I've actually literally, this is not an overstatement, I've actually stopped somewhere to go to the bathroom and left and went the wrong way. So I can't find anything, but we were traveling yesterday with my sponsor, and we rented a car. We all four of us rode in the same car from Las Vegas to here, and he claims to have be able to find things, good sense of direction and everything. So I guess what we basically did, we sort of toured Las Vegas for an hour, maybe hour and a half, and drove around, and finally we went back by the airport, and he said, well, there's the airport. So, we were going to Richmond one time to do an AA thing. I had just been to Richmond. And I can't find anywhere. And the lady that had invited me to a little small Friday night speakers meeting had given me concrete directions. About a 2 or 3 hour trip from my house. And I had followed those directions right into there, this little church. It was out of the way. And it was very difficult to find, but I had followed those directions without missing a curve. So we were going back in just a little while to do that workshop. And I told Tom, I said, now, do you want me to get directions? He said, I've been going to Richmond for 35 years. And I know Richmond like the back of my hand. And that afternoon, when we got almost to Nashville, Tennessee, we stopped at a bar and got a drunk guy to tell us how to get to Richmond. So it's good. I've made an exhaustive study of Tom is my sponsor. It's good. I want to let you know I do have a sponsor. He ain't here this weekend, but he's been sober 2 years longer than I have, and he's fond of saying that they taught things in that first 2 years he was in AA that they don't teach anymore, which is fine with me. But one of the things I've learned, I've made an exhaustive survey of my sponsor and his sponsor for the last many years and made a close up front study of them and how they live their lives. And it's good to know. You know, I really think that you can't love someone unless you know what's wrong with them. Otherwise, it's just fluff. I mean, we have to understand the whole thing. And who better should be able to grasp that than members of Alcoholics Anonymous? Because we come in here because we can't do anything else. There's a lot of definitions of what Alcoholics Anonymous is and what it isn't. My very favorite definition, the preamble is awfully hard to beat, but my very favorite definition of what Alcoholics Anonymous is, if I just had to make up one and I had to give a very concrete, straight-at-em answer, I'd say that what Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life slightly more powerful than the illness of alcoholism. And if somebody asked me what alcoholism is, I would say that what alcoholism means to me is I can't live with drinking or I can't live without drinking. There was no mystery in the fact the first time I ever heard someone say that the majority of alcoholics who took their own life did it sober. Nobody had to explain that to me. I understood that very clearly. That's where I'd be right now. I know it's like 10 o'clock in the morning in Las Vegas, but I don't care what time it is or where we're at. If booze still did what it did for me when I was a 17 or 18-year-old kid, I don't mind telling you, I'd be in one of them broken-down country western bars right now, and I'd have some half-dressed slinkstress in there with me telling me how good I am. She'd know it was a lie, and I would too, but it doesn't make any difference. I mean, the first liar doesn't have much of a chance in there. But my very favorite definition of what Alcoholics Anonymous is that snapshot into the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book where it says, AA's 12 steps are a set of principles, spiritual in their nature, if practiced as a way of life, will do two things. It says it will expel the obsession to drink and render the sufferer to be usefully whole, something to that effect. Now, I know what expel means. That's what they did to me when I was a kid in school. I know what that means. And the other thing it says, probably the correct use of the word enable, it says it will enable the sufferer to become usefully whole. I think I might have screwed up that first definition a little bit, but you get the point I'm trying to... It will enable the sufferer to become usefully whole. Having the obsession to drink expelled and becoming usefully whole was not even a good fantasy when I got here. So what I think Alcoholics Anonymous is it's made up of many parts of a great whole. I don't think that meetings... I like to remember that meetings are just one thing that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a home group. I'm very devoted to meetings. I go to a lot of meetings. I don't think I've ever went. I've never quit going to meetings. The fact is, I've probably made every mistake in Alcoholics Anonymous that I can think of except three. One mistake I've never made is I've never taken a drink of alcohol since I quit drinking. May 26, 1975 is my sobriety day. Never taken another drink of alcohol from that moment right up to this moment. That's number one. It's hard to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and drink liquor, too. I've never taken a drink of alcohol since I got here. Second mistake I've never made is I've never quit going to meetings. Got to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to attend meetings. There was that article a few years ago in the Grapevine, I guess, I mean, I wrote in a rebuttal to it, but that article, it was somebody had quit going to AA, was shooting at the idea of meetings, 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 remember that? And they published that thing about, you know, all this overkill about meetings. Well, it's hard to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous without attending meetings. I mean, I've never made that mistake. I've never quit going. I believe what it says in that particular tradition about most alcoholics can't recover without the group. I believe that to be true. The third mistake I've never made is I've never trusted the wrong person. I've got a drunken uncle that's always fascinated by the fact that he always brings it up every time I see him, every year or 2 years, that I was willing to take direction in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, that's no secret to me. The great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is you get to pick your leaders. I'll assure you now, there's people in AA that I wouldn't have drank with unless I was broke. Now, I've never met an alcoholic I wouldn't drink with if I didn't have anything to drink. But I'll guarantee you there's people in here I wouldn't have drank with if I had a choice. So the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is you get to pick your own leaders, and that's been a great thing for me. I've been able to follow people, and it's been my experience here that I've been able to follow people that are absolutely spiritual giants. I don't think necessarily in terms of their godliness. I think in terms of their commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous and their belief that drinking not only will not happen, it's impossible. That you cannot possibly practice these principles to the best of your ability and drink liquor too. And it looks like to me, this is a bit of an overstatement, but it looks like to me that people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and practice this thing in two basic ways. This is a bit of an overstatement. And I'm certainly not an expert on alcoholism. I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. Any speaker should say that. In fact is, I would never want to be looked on as a speaker. What I am is I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who sometimes is called on to make a talk, but I would never want to be looked on as a speaker. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've taken advantages of all parts of Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy in my home group, when he introduces speakers, always likes to say that. He said, at our group, we look for speakers who have taken advantages of everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. And that's what I certainly hope that I've done. But it looks like to me people approach this thing in two basic ways. One is the man or woman who comes in here and is socialized into a kind of Alcoholics Anonymous where they're taught to put these principles into practice in all areas of their life and put them first and do what they're supposed to do and everything else will automatically come along. in 2 weeks, if I can make it, if I don't take a drink or don't die, I'm going to be sober 28 years. And right up to this very moment, I've never seen one single man or woman who practiced Alcoholics Anonymous in that way who has not come out just fine. No matter what the reversal, no matter what the tragedy, no matter what the provocation, no matter what happened. I've watched people deal here with the imminence of their own death, with the most horrible tragedy, with things going on, I mean, that were awful. And you wouldn't even know that they had any problem going on unless you personally knew them. They were practicing these principles. Not only were they staying sober and doing what they were supposed to do, they were cutting the path for me and for others to follow. So I've never seen one single man or woman who put these principles first in their life who hasn't come out just fine. The other way it looks like people have practiced Alcoholics Anonymous, and it looks like to me this is a more common way, is that they try to fix up their life believing that their drinking will come along. And I've never seen one single person recover that does that. I was so grateful that I was taught that I didn't have to try to do anything other than practice these principles to the best of my ability. That's all I had to do. Everything else was going to have to be done as a byproduct of that. I mean, I didn't have any other way of getting any money, so I was going to have to work. That was a revolting revelation. There's big money on both sides of my family. I'm talking about real big money. I got a great aunt and uncle who have their name on a building at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. You've got to give a couple, $3 million to get that. But I'll tell you the one thing, there's no doubt in my mind, I ain't never going to see any of it. I had a guy tell me one time, he said, I wouldn't give you a penny if you needed a new heart. So I don't think that there's any chance that I was going to get any of that money. But I'm a member of a home group. It's an excellent group. We're one group that meets twice a week. I'm a member of the Principals Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Raleigh, North Carolina. I don't know if it's the best group of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world or not. I hear people say that. I don't hear it as much as I used to, but I hear people say that. I ain't been to all the groups of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world, but I know mine's the best one for me. I know that. And we're on 4400 Buffalo Road in Raleigh. If you're looking for a meeting, that's where we're at. We're there on Tuesdays and Thursday nights. We're one group that meets twice a week. On Tuesday night, the first Tuesday night of the month, we study the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The second and third Tuesdays, the chairman picks a topic out of Alcoholics Anonymous literature, shares their experience, strength, and hope on that, and then calls on other people to do that. On the fourth Tuesday of the month, we do a tradition in conjunction with the month so that we circle the field. We'll do the traditions throughout the... I sobered up in a group, the only group I've ever heard of, I sobered up in a group that studied the traditions on Saturday night. I think there's tremendous relevance and fun and all kinds of stuff in the traditions. I know sometimes people talk about how traditions are boring. I just haven't found that to be true. I know that so often in life things seem one way, but in truth they're another. I used to sponsor a dentist who passed away in the year 2000, and since then I go to a lady dentist. And I absolutely deplore going to the dentist. I hate it. But this dentist's office is altogether different. It's real, there's a lot of enthusiasm in there. There's little kids running all around. She's got stuff set up for little kids. She doesn't try to muffle it. Everybody that's in there is real enthusiastic and outgoing and pumped by what they're doing. And I just love this dentist. She pops off a lot. She says things like, I practice dentistry that doesn't hurt. Anybody that's practicing dentistry in this day and age that hurts doesn't know what they're doing. I do root canals that don't hurt. I've been doing root canals for 20 years. My root canals don't hurt. Anybody doing root canals that hurts people don't know what they're doing. Ought to go back and learn how. She says stuff like that. I mean, I don't... She claims she's never been a drunk, but she sounds like one. But, I mean, things are not always the way they seem. I had a root canal. I guarantee you the root canal didn't hurt. Just what she said. The great philosopher, Dizzy Dean, Hall of Fame baseball player, I think he was a drunk, but people said he was. He said one time, I heard him say it, he said, if you can do something and you say it, it ain't bragging. So, you know, she says stuff that, I mean, things sound one way, but in truth they're another. The traditions have tremendous relevance and power. And then on the fifth Tuesday night of the month, there's three or four months of the year that have five Tuesdays, we study Alcoholics Anonymous history, believing that our collective history is as important to us individually as our individual history. It's what I believe about my own alcoholism, is that if I forget what it is that brought me here, I believe it's getting ready to happen again. It took me years to understand why you studied history in school. It just didn't make any sense to me. It's so we don't have to relive it. I mean, I don't live in fear of the first drink. In fact, is anybody that I've ever known intimately in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not something we usually talk about, but anybody that I've ever worked with intimately or known intimately has shared with me that they came upon a time in their sobriety where they knew that they would not have to drink again one day at a time unless they demanded to. It happened to me when I was about a year and a half sober. My great aunt had taken me in. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous homeless. I was hemorrhaging blood. I was in a very dangerous physical condition. I was in bad shape. But after about a year and a half, I had come back some, and I remember telling my great aunt that I believed that I had found a way that I would not have to drink again one day at a time unless I demanded to drink. And I think that's supported by our literature. Dr. Bob says it several times in our history. They asked him one time if he thought he'd ever drink again. And he said, I don't think I'll ever drink again one day at a time as long as I live unless I quit doing what I've been doing. So I think it'd be foolish for me to stand up here and say I'll never drink again. I like to qualify that very much. If I continue to do, right up to this very moment, if I continue to put all the jets of Alcoholics Anonymous in place at one time, then I think I'm going to be safe from alcohol here. If I could practice these principles to the best of my ability and still drink liquor too, then there'd be no miracle here. Then what we would have here is a crapshoot. What I've learned here is that problems had very little to do with drinking. Now, I had a lot of big problems when I was drinking, but they were rarely ever solved. Now, I've had way more problems since I quit drinking. It just makes sense. It just makes sense. I became sensitized. I took my place in the world. I began to learn how to live. I began to grow up here, and life went on. I mean, a guy said one time, the best way to find out if you got any problems, check and see if you're breathing. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Bill Wilson said that. I mean, at some point, we're not supposed to. AA is a bit of a subculture. Otherwise, we wouldn't have closed meetings. But at some point, we've got to take our place in the world and be of maximum service to God and our fellows. So I think if I put all the jets of Alcoholics Anonymous in place, I'm going to be just fine. I made the mistake one time many years ago. I know people always preface these statements by saying an old-timer, they call him Sonny, but this old man actually did call me Sonny. He's 84 years old. I just talked to him the other day. He's out in Iowa. His name was General Kimston. And I remember telling him many years ago, I almost need sunglasses up here. I remember telling him many years ago that the history of Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot like eating ice cream. It's good and it's fun, but you don't really need it to live. And General always called me Sunday, and he hung his head, shook his head like that, you know how they do, and said, Sonny, how could you say something so foolish? How could you explain to me how it is that you don't need to understand the history of the program that's given you life? Would you please explain that to me? How is that possible that you don't need to understand that and need to have walked in these people's and best of understanding as you possibly can and know? I've had the opportunity to take the history tour in Akron a couple of times, and what a fascinating experience. You know, to go to the Mayflower Hotel, it's an old people's home now, but, you know, if you're a little bit, you know, all those old skills don't die. We just waited there until a real old lady came out with a granddaughter, and we told her, you're supposed to have a little card, just like a card to get in this motel room, you know, in your motel room, and you can go on in. Well, we didn't have one, so we just stood there, and an elderly lady came out with her granddaughter, and we told her what we wanted. She said, well, go on in. So we went in. This is the last time I was there, and while we were in there, a fire drill went off, and we looked up, and there was a couple, three people that looked like they worked at the Mayflower, and then an Akron City policeman flying through there. And when they saw us, the policeman, I guess he was close to being polite, but he was more businesslike. And he stopped, and he wanted to know exactly what it is we were doing in there. So we went to explain, and we were from Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, oh, I know, you want to see the phone, don't you? But, you know, what a moving experience. And, you know, to see all of that and to walk around in there. And we went to the home of Dr. Bob and Ann Smith. And the table in there, and the walk around in there, and the gatehouse, the Cyberlane Gatehouse, and King School, and we went to the gravesite of Dr. Bob and Ann Smith, and what a powerful experience. I think what that does for me is it makes me understand them as just alcoholics who are trying to find a way. God could have gave this miracle to us any way He wanted to. I mean, He could have worked it out so that when you had enough booze, just call you on the telephone and you're done, and something happens. But He worked it out. You know, somebody who's always felt like they were pond slime, less than. The speaker last night, you're not going to hear a better talk this weekend than you heard last night, as far as Alcoholics Anonymous goes. Speakers don't compete with each other, but you couldn't hear a better talk than what you heard last night as far as the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. You heard a guy explain exactly what we're supposed to do at these meetings. The reason I love speaker meetings, not being the speaker, but the reason speaker meetings are my favorite kind of a meeting is it's the purest form of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that we've got. I try to be very mindful of the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous meetings are just one thing we do here. If we understand this as Alcoholics Anonymous, I would submit we're in a lot of deep trouble. Alcoholics Anonymous meetings are just one thing that we do, and at the threat of sounding a little bit goofy, we may be a little bit over-identified with meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous. Meetings are just one thing that we do. They're extremely important, but I need to be very clear in my mind that Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life, and that I've got to be practicing that at all times. And if I'm not, there's going to be fallout. So, It's a good thing to remember. Now, what I'm going to do here this morning is going to take me about 2 or 3 hours to finish up. When I first got to North Carolina in 1989, I'd been sober about... I want to finish up on the home group. Our speakers meeting is on Thursday night. We've got an open speakers meeting on Thursday night. So if you're in Raleigh and you're looking for a good meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're there and you're welcome. When I first came to North Carolina in 1989, a guy told me one time, he said, you never have to worry about being alone in Alcoholics Anonymous in North Carolina unless you talk 5 minutes after nine at night. So I'll try to be mindful of that. The other thing that I had never seen until I got to North Carolina, I'd been sober about 14 years when I went to North Carolina. To the best of my knowledge, I never sat in a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous where the chairman opens a meeting and then asks if anyone's got a problem. And then someone brings up a problem, and then 15 or 20 brain scientists take a crack at that problem. And then what you do is you leave the meeting goofier than when you came. I'd never seen anything like that. I mean, I go to the meeting, I'm fine. I'm just walking around fat, dumb, and happy. I don't know if I'm on foot or horseback. Everything's fine. I go in the meeting, somebody brings up a problem. They bring up something that doesn't have spit to do with anything. 15 or 20 brain scientists take a shot at that problem. I leave there goofier than when I came. I leave the meeting looking for help. So I'll guarantee you, we don't do that. We don't do that in my group, but that's where we're at if you're there. So what I want to be very mindful about is about a kind of Alcoholics Anonymous that has given me life, and that what I think my job in life is to practice these principles to the best of my ability, and then other things will come my way, and that's been my experience. I've got my wife with me this weekend, and like a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess in life, I had more than one wife. And I've got a guy I sponsor. He's getting ready to get married again, I think, pretty soon. But he always likes to say, when he's talking about his ex-wife, he says, my first ex-wife. And that's the only one he's got. I don't know why he says that. He says, just keep people, throw them off a little bit. As bad as I did it the first time, that's how good I've done it the second time with the wife I've got now. You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that. I mean, I guess you could say, this may be a bit of an overstatement, too, because I'd certainly like to get better. I'd like to get less fearful. I'd like to get less agitated. All kinds of things. But I guess you could say I'm very close to that idea of what happiness is. Happiness is having what you have, wanting what you have. That I'm not looking for anything. There's no place to go. I'm already here. I don't have to find anything anymore. All I have to do is show up and practice these principles to the best of my ability. And then things in life already happen. I don't have to go out and hunt things to happen. I just have to stay here and practice these principles. I was in a little discussion meeting many years ago that had got a little off. And the meeting was on God's will, and it was on 3rd and 11th step kind of stuff. And there was a school administrator that I always liked, a very practical guy. And they called on him, and he shot it right, he got it right down on the line. He said, tell you the truth. He said, if it's a work day and I wake up, he said, I never ask God if I'm supposed to go to work. He said, I ain't got any other way of making any money. He said, I figured all that was taken care of when I got sober. You know, there's people down there waiting for me to go to work. I've got a school to look after. I just figure I ought to go ahead and do that. So that's how I think that this thing works best. If I take my place as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a recovered alcoholic that's got to live in the world that I don't understand, what Bill Wilson said, we've been restored to the world that we rejected and that rejected us. And we come out, we do take our place in a bit of a, we go underground a little bit. Well, otherwise, there wouldn't be such a thing as closed meetings. If there wasn't a place for us to kind of retreat. But I've never been a fan of open discussion meetings. What I think open meetings should be are speaker meetings or workshops. I think there needs to be a place where alcoholics talk to alcoholics in a language of the heart that's so clear in our literature and that we understand. Nobody needs to tell us what we're talking about. We already know that. Anyway, I want to share a little bit about my drink, and I want to let you know that I did drink. I've actually heard people say, I don't know what kind of alcoholic you have, but I've actually heard people say they didn't go to speaker meetings because they already knew how to drink. I love to hear about drinking, and we talk about it, not as a prisoner of our past, but to stay current to it. And I found that Alcoholics Anonymous is an excellent place to run a little ignorant. This is a place to stay a little bit green and stay connected. What I've found, probably the same thing you've noticed, is the smart ones don't tend to stay in here as long. People who come in here giving answers don't tend to stay as long. People who come here looking for answers tend to stay a little bit longer. And there was no way for me to know when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just right for this thing. There was no way for me to know that when I came here. But what I did is I came to Alcoholics Anonymous running away from what I had. I didn't come to AA thinking it would work for me. I came here running away from what I had. I was convinced of one thing, and I know now, and it was spoken of last night so well, could not be spoken of better, as the gift of desperation. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous knowing one thing. I either had to find a new way to live or I wanted to die. I knew that. I'd had a plan to die for the last couple, 3 years. I even had some ways of doing it. I had two or three ways that I figured I was going to get out of the life I was in. One was to marry a rich woman. Now, as confused as I was, even as confused as I was, I could tell that the chances of that happening were getting smaller on a regular basis. That probably wasn't going to happen. I had a plan to get a job. That was looking more and more bleak. You know, there's a time in there where you're drinking where it looks like it's going to make sense, doesn't it? I'd sit in that bar day after day after day thinking about going and getting a job, and there'd be a time in there when it makes sense. Just like there'd be a time when you actually could eat if you'd go do it right now. You know, there's a time when you can stop. If you eat, you could eat something right now, but, a couple more drinks will take care of that. And the other plan was to kill myself, and I would play that over time after time after time, and I would see that funeral going on, and I'd think, man, they're going to be sorry now. They had a chance to do something about this at one time. They could have done something about this when they had a chance. I hope they suffer now, day after day. Towards the end of my drinking, I had ended up in a place called Bill's Bar. Now, I'm well aware of the fact that the majority of people who drink alcohol in this country drink it with complete control. The book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think our other literature, talks about drink with impunity. What that means is that they can handle it. Whoever got those lights off, I appreciate it. Don't touch them again. I asked Bonnie, a lady chairing a meeting, about these lights. I said, they turn these things off, don't they? She said, no. She said, only thing I can figure, they make it as tough for us up here as they can. I said, well, you got a talking point on them. But anyway, I ended up in a place called Bill's Bar. And, the majority of people who drink alcohol in this country drink it with control. They absolutely don't have any control with it. And I think that's a true statement. And the other thing is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, every man or woman diagnoses their own alcoholism. I can't decide for anybody else if they're an alcoholic or not. Every man or woman for themselves. We keep our own time. The great guardian here is booze, isn't it? Besides sponsors and principals and home groups, the great guardian is booze. If you're an alcoholic of my description and you don't conform to certain spiritual principles, you sicken and you drink. And booze will get you out of here. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it'll take you out of here. There's absolutely no way that's not going to happen. So every man or woman judges their own alcoholism. I can't decide anybody else's alcoholism. Now, with all of that said, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to take a chance on saying those people in Bill's Bar were an alcoholic. What you could have done at that time is you literally could have backed a farm truck up to Bill's Bar and put everybody in there and carted them to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you wouldn't have missed a person. You had to be drunk to stand it in there. Even the people that worked in there were drunk. Bill made his fortune in the garbage and septic tank business on the south end of town, and he bought that bar as a toy for his drunken wife, Phyllis. And what they did, when Bill sold the bar he had before that, they told him, I was in the military at that time, but when Bill sold that bar, they put a thing in the contract that he couldn't open another bar in Fremont, Nebraska for 3 years because all the drunks would follow him down to his new bar. And I'm always struck in North Carolina by how few bars there are. I live in a town, it's amazing how few, I don't know how people get respectfully drunk there. In Nebraska, where I'm from, the speaker here, I don't know if she's in here tonight, this morning or not, but Karen is from Lincoln, Nebraska. 50 miles where I'm from. I'm an alumnus of the Lincoln, Nebraska VA psychiatric ward, where I'd like you to know I was a ping pong champion. I remained undefeated. I lost one game the whole time I was there. I sent for my headband, and I remained undefeated. But I was a ping pong champion in VA psych ward. But all in Nebraska, bars are everywhere. Karen will support that. I grew up in a town 50 miles from Lincoln, 30 miles from Omaha, Fremont, Nebraska. It's a town of about 25,000 people. On Main Street, there are bars up and down both sides. I sobered up at a place called Chapter 5, about a block and a half from Bill's, between two bars. Now, in Bill's Bar, we had some colorful people in there. We had a guy named Vibrator Hartman. And Vibrator got drunk and burned up in a fire. We had a guy named Rodney Montaney. Rodney got drunk, got in a fight with a guy in a wheelchair and tipped him over. That ain't good. The way Rodney described that, he said, he hit me a good one, Steve, but I tipped him over before they got me out of there. We had a guy named Leonard Larson. Now, Leonard had no neck. His head sat right on his shoulders. And Leonard had taken one too many shots to the head. What Leonard would do is he'd get drunk and crawl around on his hands and knees and lift bar stools to perform feats of strength. We had a guy in there said one time, at midnight in the bar, Leonard can lift everything in here but his own body. My fighting weight at that time was about 125, 30 pounds. I needed a few pounds on it, but I used to jump up and down on his stomach to perform feats of strength. Nebraska's old, and it's got, except for metropolitan Omaha, Nebraska is flat, and it's cattle country and big red football, but it's You know, it's a beefsteak. They've got old laws, and they've got rustling laws in the book. Leonard went out in the country one day and shot a cow, and he stumbled out to a country road to get somebody to help him load it in the back of his pickup truck and waved down an off-duty deputy sheriff. He got 1 to 2 years for shooting that cow. We had another guy named Pee-wee Holtgren. Now, Pee-wee would go drunk, and he'd just be dead weight. He'd been a jockey at one time, or claimed to be. There's no, unless you're there with a flashlight, you'd never know if any of this stuff is true about what they told you in Bill's bar. But Pee-wee claimed to have been a jockey, and what happened with Pee-wee is he'd just go drunk. He'd go out wherever he was at, and he was dead weight. You couldn't move him. So he'd pass out at the bar, a great big, long, mahogany bar, and what would happen when the police would walk through there on Friday or Saturday night, somebody would hold Pee-wee's head up like this in the mirror. So the police would see it. When they'd get on the other side, they'd just drop Pee-wee, and his head had bounced, but he didn't know it. But the two most colorful characters we had in there, and also in Bill's bar now, that the country music went all the time, day and night. Even today, I question people's alcoholism that don't listen to country music. They may not have been alcoholics. They might have been heavy drinkers, for all I know, but that country music went all the time. And we had colorful characters, and we had two brothers came in there named Billy and Tommy Walker. Now, I had gotten out of the military the summer of 1972, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay Memorial Day weekend of 1975. During that almost three-year period of time, I worked a total of about 6 weeks, but I was drunk all the time. So you know there were some very lean times in there. But two brothers came into town by the name of Billy and Tommy Walker, and when they came into town, they fell immediately into Bill's bar and started drinking in there, and I started drinking with them, got to know them. And you know, it's a funny thing, you know, there were, you know, I've always known things all my life from the time I was a little kid that I don't know how I knew. I can remember as a little kid being terrified and my mom telling me everything was all right, but I knew that was not the case. I've always known things that I don't know how I know. Even today, I'll hear myself talking to a newcomer sometimes. I just started sponsoring a brand new guy. I just came in February. And I'll hear myself talking to a newcomer, and I'll say something. I'll say, I wonder, how do I know that? Where did that come from? I've always known things that I didn't know. And sometimes that's good, and sometimes that's bad. But when Billy and Tommy Walker came to town, the day I met Billy Walker, he told me that he was out of the 101st Airborne. Now, that's been over 30 years ago. I knew that day that was a lot. And it's, I don't know where he's at today. He claimed to have been from Texas. I'm looking for him, because if he's alive, I'll guarantee you he's either in Alcoholics Anonymous or locked up, the way we were going. There were precious few choices. But he claimed to have come out of the 101st Airborne. I knew that day that was a lie, and over 30 years later today, as well as I'm standing here, I know that was a lie. There was no doubt the day he told me that, and there's no doubt in my mind today that where he had just come from was a penitentiary somewhere. No doubt in my mind. When I was drinking, there were things that, you know, we're talking about not knowing, knowing things and trying to do stuff, but not knowing. You know, as confused as I was, I would do things sometimes that I was so appalled and devastated by my own behavior that I didn't know anything about making amends or mending situations or making them correct or current, but I would try to fix what I had done. I just knew stuff. And that can be a horrible burden. Sometimes I think we're just better if we were just struck with ignorance. That's why I think that the longer you're sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and take a drink, the less chance you've got of getting back here. See, my chances of staying sober the rest of my life, I submit, are better than the guy that said he's 30 days sober. I think if you just look at the science of that, my chances of staying sober the rest of my life are better than his. If I take a drink and he takes a drink, his chances of coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, the odds just reverse themselves. The longer you're sober and you take a drink, the less chance I got of getting back here. You know, once I know there's an answer and I don't surrender to that answer and follow that, I mean, the worse it gets. But anyway, I knew that Billy Walker was lying, and they came to town, and Billy Walker drank dry gin and chased it with squirt, and his brother Tommy Walker drank bar whiskey and chased it with water. And when I started drinking with him, I started drinking that dry gin. Now, anybody drinking dry gin, if they ever tell you they're drinking that stuff for taste, they need some kind of an evaluation. It's nasty. I mean, you might as well be drinking hair oil or perfume or gasoline or something. It's just nasty. But anyway, I started drinking that dry gin and chasing it with squirt. And Billy Walker, this is the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar at this time. He told me, he said, there's a couple things you got to remember. The way we're drinking this gin, he said, what you do is you get the gin in a separate glass, and then you fill it up with squirt. Now, I don't know if they got squirt in Nevada. They don't have it in North Carolina. I told this story one morning in West Virginia, and after the meeting, a guy came up to me and handed me a can of squirt. But all squirt is a kind of soda. And he said, what you do is you get the gin in a shot glass, and then you get the squirt in another glass. And what you do is you drink the gin down real fast. Don't breathe while you're drinking it. And as soon as you swallow it, then you suck down the squirt. And he said, the reason you don't want to breathe is this gin's nasty. And if you smell it, you know, it's nasty. It can make you gag. So drink it down fast, and all right, makes sense to me. Now, the second thing he said threw me a little bit. He said, the other thing you got to do is start to use a lot of pepper on your food. We weren't eating much in those days anyway, and I said, well, what will pepper do? And he said, well, the way we're drinking this gin, he said, it hurts your liver. But he said, if you use a lot of pepper on your food, it's been known to counteract liver damage. Now, that's what he said. That's the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar at that time. The other reason I like to drink with Billy Walker, there was two reasons. One is I had a big mouth. I didn't intend to have a big mouth. It's just the way it worked out. I'd bring up stuff. To this day, I can remember, the last couple years of my drinking, every time I would wake up, I would be physically sick. And I'd get a little bit to stay down, and sometimes it's more difficult than others, but by the time I'd, get well again, there'd be just a little period in there where I'd be drunk, and then I'd never remember again. But my plan, day after day, was I say, I'm not going to drink anything but beer today. And there was literally a time when I was a kid, I could drink beer for 24 or 30 hours. Remember that old deal about drink yourself sober? When you're a kid, I never have known if that's true or not. I know that everything they tell us in Alcoholics Anonymous is not true. You've heard that deal about the only way you can sober up is through time. You don't sober up anyway. That's a lie. And I'll tell you how I know it's a lie. I was horribly drunk one night. I was so drunk I could barely walk, but a guy, he's dead now, a policeman shot him, but a guy by the name of Cecil Woodgate put a .357 up to my head, and he kept pushing it. And I asked him, I said, Cecil, is that thing loaded, or are you just trying to scare me? And he hung it out the window and fired it. Now, I'll tell you, I sobered up some. So, everything that they say here is not true. I had a big mouth. And so I would try to plan to stay on beer, but it would just never work. And when I would drink beer for 24 hours or whatever, I would be drunk, but I could remember stuff. I could talk to people, I could drive a car. I'd have been, drunk driving when I woke up at any time. I mean, my blood alcohol would have never flown, but I could halfway operate. But you let me take one drink of Mad Dog wine or whiskey or gin or anything, and I'm gone. I never remembered it. So I would bring up stuff. Now, I'd be pretty safe in Bill's bar, but if we'd get out somewhere else, I'd start trouble. And I had another problem with having a big mouth. I was a coward. It's a bad combination. It just doesn't make sense that the same person is stuck with both of those things. It's like today. I can't stand a mess, and I can't stand to clean a mess up. I don't think I'm too good to clean a mess up. It just doesn't work. I've always wanted to live in one of those houses that looks like they're not lived in, but by the time I walk across the room once, it doesn't look like that anymore. But Billy Walker, at his biggest, was never any bigger than I am right now. Now, I went up a pant size a year when I got sober. I needed to. But at his biggest, he was never any bigger than I am right now. But he would attack people. He looked like that dog on the Greyhound bus. He would fly on people and take them out. And somebody would have got him as a kid, and he never started drinking. He'd probably been a great boxer with Brad Alcoholic. The other reason I like to drink with Billy Walker, there's just no other way to say this. We've all seen people like this. It's just any other way to describe it. He was just one of those people that attracted women. And my idea was, is I'll hang out here with old Billy Walker and possibly get in on some of the overflow. Well, that was my game plan, and none of that ended up. I just didn't work out that way. I want to head you towards Alcoholics Anonymous because I want to talk some about what's happened since I got here and some about the power of what keeps us here. I had been out in California. I'm going to fast forward you to the end. I had been out in California in 1974, and I'm very sick physically. Plus, I'm in that kind of alcoholism now where I desperately wanted a way out. That definition that Tom said he heard of some years ago, and I like it so much. I think it's so apt. Surrender is what happens when the demons you might get start to look better than the demons you got. I had wanted a way out for a long time. Now, depending on when you caught me, it might have looked like I knew everything in the world except how to quit drinking and how to shut my own mouth. It might have looked like that. Or it might have looked like I was dead on the inside like I was, just depending on when you caught me. But I had been out in California, and I had written a bunch of bad checks, and Phyllis had paid off a bunch of bad checks, the lady that owned Bill's bar, but she had gotten tired of that. And so I was out in California, and then I left California with a drunken uncle of mine who was running from the law. And just, the nightmare that we get into of it's always the same stuff. We talk about it 1,000 different ways, but it's always the same stuff. And there are things. The book is, I don't think there's ever been anything written as bold and as stark and is right on the barrelhead of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly the chapter to the agnostic, how that's got to be one of God's greatest senses. Write that chapter, it just reeks of spiritual power written to an agnostic. But, earlier when it's talking about alcoholism and more about alcoholism and there is a solution, when it talks about the things that happened, some of it's tragic, some of it is hilarious. There's all kinds of stuff. I left the bar in the wrong car one time. I drove a car to the bar, It was white, and I left in a car. It was white. That's the only similarity they had. And by a fluke, both of them had the keys in it. You know, I mean, all kinds of things. I had a married girlfriend one time, had her hidden out from the law and the police. I was the best man at a wedding. She was the best woman, whatever that is. The wedding went so well, we just went on the honeymoon with the people. You know, I mean, there are those kind of things that are just, I mean, just time after time after time of just, you know, just crazy. And then there's the stuff that's tragic. You know, one person lost their life because of the way I was living, and because of the hatred, and because of the alcoholism, and so, you know, there's from stark tragedy to being hilarious. But on the whole, it's just nasty. You know, alcoholism is just a diabolical, devastating illness. But anyway, I had been out in California, and Thanksgiving of 1974, I ended up in Bill's Bar again. I came back to Nebraska, and there was a lady in Bill's Bar, and as far as I know, I have never said in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I didn't know any good people when I was drinking, just alcoholics. You know, where I grew up in Nebraska is textbook alcoholism. If you really wanted to study alcoholism, you've got a work ethic there that's second to none. You've got a sense of right and wrong, and of shared purpose, and of respect for things, and of high regard for people, and all kinds of stuff. You've got people in Nebraska, I knew some of them, wouldn't go fishing on their own property without a fishing license. You got people, it's the kind of honesty, if you went in the grocery store and bought a carton of cigarettes with a $50 bill and they gave you change for $100, they'd give it back. Now, I was introduced to that kind of honesty. I was never afflicted with it. I knew about it. But I ended back up in, you know, Bill's Bar. Now, remember, I said everybody in Bill's Bar that was permanent party in there needed to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a lady in Bill's Bar by the name of Libby who came up to me in another town drunk. I'd been in a horrible tractor-trailer accident with this other guy. I won't bore you with the details, but it was a horrible accident. Just one of those flukes. The trailer came through the tractor where I was sleeping, and right up crashed above my head. I didn't even know it. I never did wake up. And they had a highway patrol out there, and the fire engine hosing off diesel fuel. I never knew about it till, you know, hours later. But this particular guy and I were invited to this lady and her boyfriend's house for Thanksgiving dinner of 1974. And I never really left. You know, and it's also funny. You know, time is hard to capture like pain is. One of the reasons I've stayed as active in Alcoholics Anonymous as I have is working with the new people and staying green and staying mindful of what this illness is and what it can do. And the other reason is I've just found the stuff I was looking for. The it I was looking for my entire life, I found in booze. The it that replaced that, I think what I was really looking for my entire life, I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. The great psychiatrist Carl Jung said that you know, it makes excellent sense when you think of it this way. Bill Wilson said one time that the alcoholic, more than most, seems to want to know what it's all about. That's always been the case with me. Carl Jung said that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol is on a low level what man's thirst for God is. So to be connected to something, to be connected to my fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous and then to these principles and to a God of my understanding is where the power is. It's where I plan to stay in the power right now for the rest of my life. But anyway, a lady came up to us in Bill's Bar and her and her boyfriend invited us to their home for Thanksgiving dinner. Now, pain and time are hard to capture. But I'm in this kind of pain now where I'm in this kind of devastation where I remember stuff, but I'm not sure if it really happened or if I just dreamed it. I don't know if I really saw somebody or I just think I saw them. I wake up, I'm freezing, I'm drenched in my own sweat, but I can't keep anything down. And she's buying quarts of beer for me to drink. She had a great, big, beautiful Thanksgiving dinner, had her kids in and some other people. Of course, I wasn't able to eat. She had a talk with me. It went very much like this. You know, I go home at night sometimes. I can't hardly remember the morning. And the last year will seem like a blur, but this was in 1974. And what I remember of that, I remember very clear. Most of it I don't remember. She had a talk with me that went just like this. She said, I've been around alcoholics all my life. I've been married to two alcoholics. And remember now, she herself was permanent party at Bill's Bar. She said, but I don't think I've ever seen anything like you at your age. She said, there's a man in town who helped my last ex-husband. My ex-husband's now been sober a full year. He's paying child support. He's doing very well. If you want me to, I'll call him. Now, you can get fairly spiritual in Nebraska when you're in the condition I'm in blizzard weather with no place to go. And plus, on the other hand, I really desperately did want help. And so she called a man by the name of Bob Brannigan, and he made the first call that was ever made on me this Saturday after Thanksgiving, the last day of November of 1974. And I understand he spent almost all afternoon with me. I only remember two or three things. I remember very clearly asking him, how do you get the willpower to not drink? And I remember what he said. He said, I look on willpower a little bit different than you do. He said, what I think willpower is taking that drink the way you take it, knowing it's going to come back up. That's what I think willpower is. And the other question I remember asking him, how long since you've drank? And he said, if I can make it till September, it'll be 11 years. Well, that's whatever that is, 28 years ago or something, and he's still sober, and I guess, what, 39 years now? And the reason he's still sober is because he's still been doing those things all those years, all these years. He carted me off to the state hospital the next day, and I was introduced to AA, and that was my introduction. I didn't stay sober. I continued to drink. I was in there 7 weeks. I continued to drink. Out of there, back in, continuing to drink. But Memorial Day weekend, I came here. And I think that you can clearly write the hand of a loving power in this program since then. My great aunt had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings on a daily basis, and things started to happen to me. I'd already taken the first step. You know, the first step says very clearly, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. What that means to me is I can't live with drinking. I can't live without drinking. It's the nature of my condition. It also says that if I stay there, to me what that means is I'm dead. I got to go somewhere for help. The very first summer that I was sober, I think I was as terrified as I ever was. I was overwhelmed by everything, but I knew that something was slightly different. What had happened for me the first summer I was sober is the second step started to move in my life. And I had a little bit of hope. That's what I think the second step is. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That started to happen for me. The third step, I went through the application of that on my knees with my sponsor. It talks about in the big book on that the third step talks about destruction of self-centeredness. It gives us a prayer, but it says the words are optional. In the 12 and 12, it talks about the principle of willingness. You know, I went through that, but I don't think, I know now what I did is I turned my life into Alcoholics Anonymous. I just turned it over to my sponsor and him and Alcoholics Anonymous. I just gave up to this power, this program, and I've never been sorry of that. I didn't know this for a number of years, but early on what I did is that I made a decision that I was going to turn my life over to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going all the way with this thing, and I've never been sorry for that. I did a fourth step early on. I did it like the book talks about, the best I could, you know, about the resentment, the fear, and the sex. Got it all down on paper. I had some horrible stuff to try to get through, but what it basically was just a compilation of all the nasty stuff in my life. I think I learned a little bit about trends and about stuff like that, about patterns, but basically what it was just every filthy, rotten, corruptible thing I'd ever done. There was some horrible stuff to get through there. There was my experience with listening to inventories is 90% of people's secrets have to do with sex, stuff they're going to take to the grave with them, and there was plenty of that, but there was a lot about resentment and a lot about fear. There was also one thing in that inventory that, as I look at it now, it wasn't within the top 20 worst things. It didn't have anything to do with anything. It didn't have anything to do with sex. It didn't have anything to do with anything. The only reason I tell you this is that I thought it separated me from every other human in the world. And when I got it down on paper, the first fifth step I took sober, I took with a Catholic priest that was a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any desire. I didn't care anything about being Catholic, but I had it in my head that a priest couldn't tell. Talk about self-centered. I mean, who'd want to tell? But anyway, when I told him that, I had some horrible stuff to try to get through, the death of another person, all kinds of stuff. But when I told him that one thing, he had some comments he wanted to make about it, and he understood about it. So the only reason I tell you that is until we get it down on paper, we've got things all mixed up. What's horrible we think isn't, and the other way around. And so it's, you know, the guidance of God and another human being is extremely important. When I left, my first fifth step, he had told me to meet him at the rectory at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, and I got up there at 10 to 9. And I left at noon a different man. I had two things happen in that inventory. When I'm working with a new man or even somebody that's been out, I just started sponsoring a guy that's been sober 13 years, just moved to North Carolina from West Virginia. When I'm working with somebody at the end of the fifth step, there's two things I always hope happen. One thing, when I left there that day after doing my fifth step with God and another human being, I knew I had come a considerable distance. I don't think anybody's going to go through that unless they believe their life depends on it. The other thing I knew without any doubt is that'd be a horrible place to stop. Again, I think there's a transition period, and we may be, again, at the risk of sounding a heretic, we may be a little over-identified with the fourth and fifth step. It looks like to me after the fifth step is where we start to lose our members if something doesn't happen. Something happened for me with the sixth and seventh step that was very similar to my life like the first step was to my alcoholism. You know, the sixth step says we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects, and the seventh step says humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Something happened for me in the sixth and seventh step where I took my place as a mature member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's where I anchored down. Now, I could get drunk, like I said, but I ain't going to just walk off and take a drink. I'm connected to power here. I'm connected to you. I'm connected. My sponsor's with me. I've read Alcoholics Anonymous literature this morning. I've started this day on my knees. I've got a desire to serve. I understand what I'm supposed to do with these things. I'm not supposed to just come here and make a talk. I'm supposed to participate. The way Tom explained it to me, if you want to see, and from the time you get there until the time you leave, stack chairs, hear inventory, do it, listen to other people. Whatever they want you to do is what you're there for. I understand that. I want to be of service. So the sixth and seventh step for me is where I anchored down. Anything that I can fix isn't much of a problem. And so some years ago, I quit using the word work about steps or anything and used the word practice. I practice these things. But the sixth and seventh step were extremely powerful to me. I personally believe all 12 steps are of equal importance. I think that's supported by Alcoholics Anonymous literature. It's like we've got three things on the triangle: recovery, unity, and service. They're all of equal importance, it would seem, to the well-ordered life, but we spend about 90% of our meetings talking about recovery. Might have something to do with our basic self-centeredness. But all steps are of equal importance. But my favorite steps, for me, just personally, are 2, 6, and 7, because it's how I understand Alcoholics Anonymous. My basic job here is to surrender and let this power move me. So the 6 and 7 steps have been incredible in my life. 8th step, made a list of all persons who had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. I got the list and I became willing. I like to be very literal about the steps. That's what the step says. What I found about getting willing is if I've done all the damage, if I'm the one that's done all the carnage, there's not much trouble to getting willing. I have trouble becoming willing where I feel like I've been damaged, when there's been spiritual warfare. So the 8th step says I get the list and become willing, and then in the 9th step, make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I've had a wonderful experience with that, and what that step at the bottom of step 9 has allowed me to do. I heard a guy say this one time, but he said if you practice the first 9 steps to the best of your ability, what you end up with is a jet engine for life, because you're connected right now to the power of this moment. You're no longer coming from behind where you're living in resentment. You're no longer operating out there in fear where you're scared. You're living right now because you're current with life. And I had wonderful experience with that. I've actually went out. We say in life that you can't change the past. But I'll tell you, at best, that's a half-truth. My understanding of the past absolutely shifted after I did the 9th step. I've literally went out to see people, made appointments to went out to see people to clean up the past, and they physically looked like a different person when I left there. I've had all kinds of wonderful experiences with that. The reason the onus has to be on me, it's very much like paying money back. People don't want my money anyway. They just want theirs back. So, you know, making amends is an essential thing to get connected. And making, you know, of all the amends, financial amends are the easiest to make. It may be hard to come up with the money, but that's a walk in the park. Where there's real difficulty in making amends, again, is when there's been spiritual warfare. I'll tell you one other quick thing. I'm headed for the home stretch on this. I'll tell you one other quick thing about making amends. One of the things I try to do now when I go around in life is I try to interact with all kinds of people and push people around and talk with them and visit with them. I've had wonderful experiences with that. I was sponsoring a young man. He's just finished his second year of law school right now. In fact, this week he's provisionally practicing law by himself in court, even though he hasn't graduated from law school, under the supervision of a lawyer who doesn't have to be there. But when he came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1997, he had been kicked out of college. His family's parents were absolutely done. The whole family was devastated. When we were doing the steps, when we got up to his amends steps in 1997, he had stolen a young man's tennis shoes last year when he was at college, and he had been kicked out of college and all of that. Well, when he went back, he got sober and went back to college. We had done everything in the world to try to find that guy that he had stolen those tennis shoes from and sold them. They were a couple $100 pair of tennis shoes. He sold them. He'd been to the registrar. He'd been to mutual friends. He tried to con everything that we knew of. And I had told him about just interacting with all kinds of people. If you see somebody that's struggling, try to make their load a little lighter. If you see somebody, you know, carrying somebody's groceries at Harris Teeter is serving God. But he was walking up the steps one day at school, and he saw this young kid with his head down, looked like he had the weight of the world on him. So he said, well, let me try what he was talking about. So he went up and started talking to this guy and said, doesn't look like you're having a very good day. He introduced himself, and they started visiting. You can probably figure out where the story's going. That guy knew where that kid was at that he had stolen tennis shoes from last year. He was at a college in another state, and my man was able to contact family, get address, contact the kid in another state, make the amends, and be current with that. So we never know what's going to happen. One of Harry Truman's great quotes in life is, you never know what's going to happen. So much true with alcoholism than with anything else. If I don't know what everything I have in life came out of my own greatest defeat, which was my alcoholism. Everything I have today is a byproduct of that. Then how can I possibly know what's good for me? 10th step, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. What I like to do is be prompt no matter how long it takes. But I think what that step does is it gives me a way to be current, to deal with each day and each day's march and to stay current. The 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. I don't know why I'm hurrying so much. I haven't even made an hour yet. I'm headed for the home stretch, though. what I think God's will for me is that I don't drink alcohol and that I live according to these principles. When I first looked at that step, that thing looked so ominous to me, I couldn't see any way that I would possibly ever get any good out of it. What I understand now, God's will for me is very simple. It's Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I got to be fairly safe on the other stuff. I think natural virtues like kindness. I think I'm supposed to go to work. I'm supposed to be loyal. I have one wife, so I sleep with one woman, pay my bills, try to be a decent parent to my children who are gone, and a decent grandparent. All of those kind of things, I try to take my place. That's what God's will is for me. No one would hope that I would take a drink. You'd have to be out of your mind. You might get hurt, too, in the fallout. So, I mean, God's will for me is a very simple thing, and if I practice that to the best of my ability, then all kinds of good things happen. It's kind of a scary thought to me to think that God might work through me. Knowing some of you as well as I do, it's equally scary to think he might work through you. I think the 11th step is a very simple thing. 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to practice these principles to the best of our ability and carry this message. Something to that effect. I think I butchered that a little bit. I know where a spiritual awakening came from. I had a lady ask me one time many years ago, she said, what word do you think is the most grabbing word in the 12th step? And I guessed every word other than the word the. And this lady had been an English teacher, and she said, no, the word in the 12th step that makes that step go is the word the. And I said, well, how do you figure that? And she said, well, the word the explains where a spiritual awakening comes from. It's the result of the first 11 steps. In other words, you don't have to do anything in life other than practice the first 11 steps to the best of your ability. A spiritual awakening moves in as the result of that. It can't not move in. It's absolute. It's coming in. And it'll happen as a result of that. So I've tried to do that. I have done that. My spirit's been awakened. I've had tremendous things happen here to me. I've had all kinds of stuff happen. I've given a guy his last drink that's going to be sober 27 years pretty soon. I've had all kinds of things happen. I've been able to participate in a number of people's lives. I've been able to sponsor people and pass this thing on. I've been able to do all kinds of these things. The principles that this program has given me, I've been able to live by them and to take my place here as a recovered alcoholic. You know, it's an amazing thing. I think Eddie hit on it last night. We can be pond slime or feel like we're pond slime all our life and come in here and get a hold of this thing and then begin to straighten all of that out. Take our place, and then not only do all of those things, but reach out the hand of the man or woman behind us. What a powerful deal. It'll keep us going forever. I heard a guy say that one time. He said, when you get to the 12th step, you come to the step that keeps you going forever. And I think that's very true. In closing, I want to tell you a couple, three little things that have happened to me that I think sort of talks about the difference in life. I've always been a guy. I don't know if all alcoholics are like this. It seems like the ones I've worked with, I don't know if it's just a more ragged bunch or not. I think they're pretty close to this. I've always been a guy that at least part of the time has to justify my existence. You know, I've always wanted to know what this thing's all about and all of those things. And so the Alcoholics Anonymous has been a great answer in that respect. But if I had to point in my life the things that have happened or that I've, you know, tried to... My old sponsor back in Nebraska, he's on May 31st, he's going to be sober 48 years. And he always liked to say that if he could stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous till he died, continue to work with others and do everything he's asked in Alcoholics Anonymous, what he believes when he leaves out of here is that it's all done. That God has got it all worked out, so he's equal. He's done now. He's got it all cleaned up. Everything that he screwed up, he's got some way to clean that up, and he's equal with the past. And I don't know if that's true, but what a kind, gentle, easy way to live. If I had to point to things I've done, when I was sober about 3 years, I got a guy out of jail one time that he lived in the post office or in jail, and he got sober. He'd been homeless for many, many years, and he had lost his children, went into prison as a young man. For whatever reason, he'd been trying to get sober for many, many years, and we never know where this gift is going to settle down. He got sober, and when he died, the day after he died, my youngest daughter was born, and we named her after him. Now, that wouldn't mean anything to anybody else, but you know, a guy whose life has been complete squalor like his had, and he was just crazy about my older daughter, and so somehow I think that's a fitting thing. That has tremendous meaning to me. There was a guy came to see me one time. He was a legend in my part of the country in Nebraska. I was working in the court system, and he came to see me. He was dying of a very debilitating illness, and he'd been sober 100 years at this time, at least. When I first knew Herman, he was on a cane, then he went on to a walker, and then he went into a wheelchair, and he'd been sober many, many years. He came to see me in the court system, and I want to tell this with as much humility as I can. He said, young man, I've had my eye on you for many years, and he said, you've shown a remarkable recovery. This is what I want you to do. He said, go down to Emmanuel Hospital in Omaha, and I want you to look around down there and find out if an alcoholic's being treated the way they're supposed to. He said, one of my daughters took her nurse's training at Emmanuel Hospital, and I'd like to make an endowment to the university. And I get all kinds of solicitations in the mail, and he said, the And when I see someone's name and there's an MD or a PhD after, it means nothing to me. You go down to that hospital and find out if an alcoholic is being treated the way they're supposed to. If you come back and tell me they are, I'm going to endow that hospital. If you come back and say they ain't, I ain't. Now, again, that wouldn't have any meaning to anybody. Last story. When I was, Rusty's here somewhere, the paper, when I was out in Arizona in January, I met a man who actually worked with Dan Golden. This is the last story I'm going to tell you. A guy named Dan Golden was one of the early members, one of the very early members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, I got sober in Omaha in 1975. At this time, Dan Golden was living in Omaha. He'd gotten sober in the mid-30s, somewhere at that time, and he'd gotten sober in Detroit. He was an early member. He went to the first morning scheduled AA meeting that was ever held in the morning. But we'd get him to talk to us about history, and I've always been a great fan of Dr. Bob. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it was any AA member's office that you went in and had any age on them at all, had a picture of Bill in there and a letter from Bill and all that, but it was much more unusual. Dr. Bob left out of here in 1950, so it was much more unusual to find somebody who knew Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob's always been my man. He's always been my favorite, and so what we'd get Dan Golden is to come and tell us stories about the history. And he was a great friend of Archie's, a man who mastered fear in the third edition of the Big Book and started AA in Detroit. And he'd tell us stories about him and Archie hanging out with Dr. Bob and Ann Smith. And when Dan Golden passed away, he left in his will with the guy he sponsored that I'd be one of the pallbearers. Now, who wants to be a pallbearer at a funeral anyway? I mean, it wouldn't mean anything to anybody in the world. But I wouldn't trade that for $1 million. Now, I'd take them both. It takes $1 million and half. But I wouldn't trade it because, I mean, it symbolizes to me the difference in what's important. I lied. I'm going to tell you one more story. I sponsored a guy that's sober 20 years. He can't learn how to read or write. He ain't never going to learn how to read or write. He's not able to learn how to read or write. I was his sponsor for many years. I'm his guardian now. I don't know how I'm supposed to do that from North Carolina. He's in Nebraska. But I've been. Those are the things that have meaning in life, to take my place here and to be an active, functioning member. In my life or in my death, the kindest thing I think that could ever be said about me is I was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really tried to live according to these principles. By the grace of God and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.